This podcast was recorded on the date indicated with the link. The views and opinions expressed herein are as of the date recorded and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities. Such views and opinions may differ from those of DoubleLine Capital or its affiliates and are subject to change without notice. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide updates or changes. Welcome to Monday Morning Minutes, hosted by DoubleLine's fixed income asset allocation strategists and portfolio managers, Samuel Lau and Jeffrey Mayberry. Please direct any comments and suggestions to minutes@doubleline.com or see us on Twitter at @DLineMinutes.
Welcome to this week's episode of DoubleLine Monday Morning Minutes. I'm Jeff Mayberry with Sam Lau.
Hey, hey.
We're recording after the close today, October 14th. I was Googling, trying to figure out what to talk about off the top here. Not much going on. So I saw 78 days until the end of the year. And then I saw also on the Twitter this morning, 37 days until World Cup kicks off.
You forgot Halloween in there. 17 days is the closest thing. So you got October 31st around the corner. Early Halloween. What are you going to dress up as this year, Jeffrey?
Well, JJ wants to dress up as Princess Daisy from Mario, so I'm going to reuse my my Luigi costume from 4 or 5 years ago. So it'll be on the cheap for me.
I'm going to go. I don't have a costume. I'm not going to wear anything, but I'm going to look for my Mario Kart game on my Nintendo 64. I've got it here somewhere. Got to figure out a way to hook it up to one of these more modern TVs, though.
All right, we'll do that and send me a picture and I'll show it to JJ.
Sounds good.
All right. Why don't we get into the where are we? We had a pretty crazy week. You know, I guess it's par for the course these days, but seemed like a pretty crazy week.
Yeah, it definitely was. I mean, as we mentioned in last week's episode of Monday Morning Minutes, that we had some market moving data points come out this week, and they definitely moved markets. So looking at the U.S. equity market, the S&P 500 is down 1.5%. You did have three sectors with a positive print: consumer staples, healthcare, and financials all managed to end the week up, with consumer staples up 1.5%. On the flip side, the remaining eight sectors are all red. Leading that way down was consumer discretionary. So you kind of had that discretionary staples on the consumer side, bookending these returns for the week-to-date basis. Moving over to fixed income, you definitely saw some moves there. I mean, you know, not to steal some of your thunder here, but on the Thursday CPI print, you saw the two-year treasury yield really just take off here. It looks like up 19 basis points on that yield to close on Friday here with a yield of 4.5%. I'll repeat that again, Jeffrey. 4.5% is the yield on the two-year note now.
And we were looking to see when's the last time we were up at this level. 2007, August of 2007 or so. Wow. We're the last time we're at the 4.5 on the two-year.
Yeah, 15 years in the making there, so to get back kind of that round trip move. And you know, we were also talking with the 10-year note. I forgot what we said. It was 2008, so almost to the day, right? October 15th, 2008 was the last time we were at these levels. So a little bit more than 10 years in the making there for the 10-year yield. We are now at a yield of 4.01% on the 10-year yield, up 13 basis points over previous week. And let me change my screen here just to see and make sure it's right. Looks like the bond just didn't make it. We got to 3.99 yield on the 30-year bond there, with a little bit of a round up to that 3.99, but that's up 14 basis points on a week-to-date basis. What that meant for some of these curves that we look at in terms of the yield spread differential, the difference between the two-year and the 10-year remains inverted at about 50 basis points. The 3-month, the 10-year yield minus 3-month yield is getting a little bit closer to inversion. It was 50 basis points positive this last week, and then this week it's just hanging on to about a 30 basis point positive steep curve there, if you can call it steep at 30 basis points, but a non-inverted curve there with the 3-month 10-year yield differential. What that meant for the ag was a lot of red. Everything underneath it is red, and thus the composite itself, the Bloomberg U.S. bond agger is down about 1.2% on the week to date. Constituents within there, the U.S. Treasury market down 80 basis points, the agency MBS market down 1.5%, and then investment grade corporate credit down almost 2% or about 2% on the week to date basis there. So definitely leading the way with a little bit of that credit pain, and then from spreads, and then also that duration that we just talked based on those rate moves that we just went over there. But across the sectors within the fixed income market that we looked at, nothing was spared. Everything red here, with bank loans the best performer on the week, down 50 basis points, followed by the high yield corporate credit market down 85 basis points. So on a year-to-date basis, all of these sectors here firmly in the red, with the best performer for the year-to-date basis remains bank loans. They're down about 4.5% there, but the worst performing sector continues to be emerging markets. That's down 26%, and IG corporate credit's not too far behind, down about 23 percentage points down the year-to-date basis. So definitely a rough year across the board for fixed income. Pretty much, if you take a look at this as I scrolled screen here, it looks like IG corporate credit market is competing with the S&P 500 for that down. On the year-to-date basis, again, IG corporate credit index down about 23%, and the S&P 500 down about 24%. So getting neck and neck in the final, what'd you say, 78 days left of the year?
Yeah, and interesting, the agency mortgage market down 15 on the year. It's a pretty big gap between agency mortgages and investment-grade corporates, you know, 7.5%, 8% difference. And we should go back and look and see if there's been any other times when there's been that large of a difference. It doesn't really seem, you know, usually they move not in lockstep, but certainly move generally the same. So I guess, you know, it's a pretty big move in duration wise, which is leading to that gap, but it seems like it's a pretty big difference, and maybe pretty it's a little wide. Bit more of a pretty more, you know, it's a good security selection or sector rotation type of market when you have that big of dispersion, where versus if you're just looking at, oh, I can do agency mortgages or treasuries, you know, the differential return there is, you know, 15 basis points or so. So not much there, but it's really that investment grade corporate bonds. If you weren't in them, you've done better. And if you were overweight investment grade, then you likely underperformed.
That's right. And, you know, given that that query that you posed there, maybe we can encourage, if we have a young enterprising analyst out there that might want to take a look at that for us here. We'll leave that, what's it called, an Easter egg out there and see if anyone comes up with that. Yep. I don't have that much conviction though, but we'll see.
We'll see.
It comes through. Yeah, so moving over to the rest of the investable assets here that we cover, the commodity index was also down, with the Bloomberg commodity index down almost 3% on a week-to-date basis, hanging into about a 16% positive return on a year-to-date basis, though. Looking within there, wow, the front month WTI futures contract down below $90 a barrel. Again, it's at just shy of $86 a barrel, down 7% on the week, but on a month-to-date basis, it's still hanging in there. So for the second week of October, it's still up 8% on the month-to-date basis and holding on to this 14% or so return, I guess, or price return on the front month there for the year-to-date basis. Gold dropped below 1,700 again. It's just hanging out at 1,640 a troy ounce, down 3.5%. Looking at it, I see the dollar index is up about 40 basis points. It's moved back up, getting closer to that 114, 115 that we saw as kind of the high this year. It's at 113 and some change there right now, up over 18% on the DXY index on the year-to-date basis. The flip side of that, looking at Bitcoin, down about 2%, just hanging on to 19,000 here, just the 19,180 bucks a coin at the time of this recording, and that's down about 60% year-to-date so far. So A whole lot of negative performance on the week. Do you want to kick us off on the macro front to see what might have been the catalyst on this week's bloodbath?
I think, you know, as we talked about last week, a pretty heavy week in terms of, or pretty heavy week in terms of the magnitude of potential changes there on the macro front. We kicked it off on Wednesday. We got the PPI numbers came out. They came in slightly above expectations. Month over month came in at 0.4% over the 0.2% expectations. If we take out food and energy, that came in right as expected at 0.3%. Both of those month over month numbers brought the year over year numbers to 8.5 and the core 7.2. We should start to see those numbers come down between now and the end of the year and in early 2023, as we have some very large numbers rolling off, over 1% per month type numbers rolling off. So even if we get the 0.4 that we got this month, the headline number or the overall year over year number should start to come down. Wednesday, we got the FOMC meeting minutes from the September 21st FOMC meeting. A couple of highlights here are that, I guess you did see a little bit of a bounce there, a little bit of a rally in bonds on Wednesday on the back of the FOMC meeting minutes. Really just a more of a idea that there's going to be, we'll just talk about the quote here. They said, quote, "It would become appropriate at some point to slow the pace of policy rate increases while assessing the effects of cumulative policy adjustments on economic activity and inflation." So really the takeaway there is the Fed may pause. They may not do what they historically have done and raise right into a crisis, raise right into a recession, and then have to cut rates. The Fed is thinking that they're going to pause. And so there's a little bit of a dovish sentiment there. Moving from that point in the minutes. Another thing that they wanted to talk about that really no one talked about in the Q&A with Chair Powell, so wanted to highlight that, is that it says a couple of participants remarked that after the process of balance sheet reduction was well underway, it would be appropriate for the committee to consider sales of agency MBS in order to enable suitable progress towards a longer run SOMA portfolio composed primarily of Treasury securities. So something we've been talking about, we knew that they were going to have to sell agency mortgages eventually, because they want to only hold treasuries, not hold any agency mortgages. And if they wanted to, unless they wanted their longer run portfolio to only take effect in 30 years, when the last principal payment on that last agency mortgage security would pay off, they would have to do some active selling there. So we're talking about it. There's really no indication that they're on the verge or on the cusp of actively selling agency mortgages. But certainly something to keep in mind as we move forward in these Fed meetings. Thursday was the big day. We got the CPI number month over month, came in at 0.4%. Headline CPI doubled the expectations of 0.2, but almost more surprising was the core number, came in at 0.6%, same as last month, versus the 0.4% that was expected. So a big surprise there on the core. That brought the year over year to headline CPI to 8.2. That brought core to 6.6. That 6.6 is the highest in over 40 years. I think Ryan Kimmel put it out that the last time it was higher than, or is that the 6.6 level, was August of 1982. So just over 40 years ago. If we kind of break out the CPI between core services and core goods, core services accelerating to the upside still at 6.7% year over year, while core goods is decelerating to 6.6%. So both right in line, but they're kind of crossing each other. One going up in terms of services and one going down in terms of goods. If we look at the shelter component, OER, owner's equivalent rent, was at 6.7% year over year and a big 0.8% month over month. If we kind of combine OER plus the rent of primary residence, and then there's a hotel stays and basically away from home, all combine all those together, was a 0.75% month over month, 6.7% year over year. And since shelter is 40% of core CPI, shelter overall contributed about half of the increase in core CPI. So it was about 0.3% out of that 0.6% in core. The good news, I saw a lot of economist talk, Twitter talk about the CPI report, and there was no good news. Do a little bit of digging, and maybe the only good piece of good news is that over the next 9 months, the CPI has averaged, the next 9 months that are going to happen, the 9 months corresponding to last year to those 9 months have to average a 0.8% for core or for CPI to stay at this 8%-ish level. So we should see CPI trend down over these next 9 months, even if we get larger month over month numbers. It's not likely to keep up with that kind of 0.8% average. So that's the only good news, is over that longer time period. We have talked about in the past the different ways of breaking down the CPI number. The Cleveland Fed median CPI is at 7.0% year over year. So they just take all the different components, whatever that median component is, that's the one they use as their median CPI. So that's a 7.0%. Over the past few months, it's gone from 5.2 to 5.5 to 6 to 6.3 to 6.7 to 7.0. So that trend is continuing to accelerate to the upside. Likewise, the Cleveland Fed also calculates the 16% trimmed mean CPI, where they cut off the top 8% and the bottom 8% in terms of the absolute numbers. That number is 7.3%. Same story as the median CPI, where it's has not peaked and continuing to accelerate to the upside. And then the Atlanta Fed calculates their sticky CPI, which is items that change price, and they put in there actually, quote, relatively slowly. That's up 6.5% year over year. So the things that change relatively slowly is up 6.5%. I guess that's only in comparison to the flexible CPI, which is up 13.3%. That's actually down from like a 20 handle that we saw earlier this summer on the flexible CPI. The sticky CPI is continuing, same as the median CPI, and the trimmed mean CPI is continuing to accelerate and hasn't peaked yet. If we do look at the jobless numbers, or the jobless numbers that came out on Thursday, nothing to see there, pretty much all the same. There was maybe a little bit of some variability due to the hurricane, but we'll see how that shakes out over the next few weeks. And then this morning, we got the retail sales number. That was flat versus the up 0.2% expectation. If we take out autos and gas, that was actually up 0.3%. So the trend is slowing, but there's still some growth there. So continuing to chug along there, I think the Fed would be pretty happy to see still growth, but slowing growth. And then this morning, we also had the University of Michigan 5 to 10 year inflation expectations. That number popped from 2.7% to 2.9%. I'm not going to cover any more of that because we're going to talk about that in the topic of the week this week. And then finally, we got some Fed speak here. This morning, Esther George, the Kansas City Fed president, said, and I thought this was interesting, I haven't really seen the Fed talk about this too much, that a higher savings buffer suggests the Fed may have to raise rates to a higher peak than they would otherwise have to be and stay at that level for longer in order for them to kind of slow demand because of that higher savings buffer that we did get from the COVID pandemic. She also said that she's been in the camp of steadier and slower rate increases, and she wants to see how these effects from the monetary lag unfold over time. I think that it's interesting that maybe they are looking at this as a, what sort of variables can be expected to make it different this time than the last time. I've heard people jokingly say that all the reforms that were instituted after the financial crisis actually have caused the Fed to be able to raise rates so much because things are so much better, so much more stable that they haven't been able to cause a financial crisis, even though they've risen rates so much so far.
I remember Yellen saying that we will not see another financial crisis in our lifetimes, right? So we'll see.
We'll see. I mean, fingers crossed on that one for sure. San Francisco Fed President Mary Daly was out also this morning saying that they're not on some sort of course that they can't correct if the economy needs more bridling or needs less bridling. But they want to increase rates to that between 4.5% and 5% is the most likely outcome. And the plan then would be on hold at that point for some period of time. I think the market's pricing in almost the same thing as what Daly was out there saying. They have 100% probability of a 75 basis point rate hike on November 2nd. Actually up to a 15% chance of a 100 basis point rate hike. So we're getting pretty close to that November 2nd point. So even a 15% chance doesn't seem like it's going to happen. I'm really take a look at that over the next week or week and a half to see where that, if we do get that 100 or 75. We do have a 60% chance of another 75 there on December 14th. And that brings the peak Fed funds rate happening on both March 22nd, 2023 and May 3rd. So Market's not pricing any change in the Fed funds rate there in the first quarter, kind of second quarter of next year. That's at 4.96. That's up 30 basis points on the week. So again, market just pricing in more Fed rate, another Fed rate hike priced in, and no Fed rate cuts. The December rate for this year is 4.5%. And December 2023 actually is up to 4.63%. So if you remember last week, the December 2022 rate and the December 2023 rate were the same. Now that actually the market's pricing in, you know, it's only a 12 point or a 11 basis point difference there, but the market's not pricing in as many Fed rate cuts in 2023 as they were last week.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just gonna say with that, that's kind of the wrap up for the week. So it was a pretty busy week, a lot of market moving events, as we could see, as we ran through in the where are we section.
Yeah, and we really got a sneak peek, from a couple of the presidents and governors of the Fed here. And prior to this CPI moving print, we were talking about how everyone would just stayed in line in terms of just talking the same language around what the expectations were for the Fed funds rate, where it would shake out, just everyone putting on the same uniform, right? Had their FOMC jerseys on. But maybe you're starting to see a little bit of a divergence there between Esther George and Mary Daly. So it'll be interesting to see how the other governors and presidents for the Federal Reserve come out next week and in the coming weeks, basically see if there's any divergences between that language, because 4.5 to 5% is really increasing pretty sharply.
Yeah, I think that we're also in the case where we're getting maybe to a cuspier point of there can be some debate about whether they're going to continue on the pace or whether they need to pause. And so starting to see people float those ideas out there, and Powell will get them back in line over the quiet period they have before this November 2nd meeting, and then they'll probably come out with the same story again for the week or 2 weeks after the Fed meeting, and so we'll kind of see how the cycle plays out as we get closer to the cuspy point.
Yeah, and absolutely, just two more remaining on the year, and then we can see where we hit that terminal rate in the first quarter or not of 2023.
Yeah, but I think to me, it feels good that they're talking about a pause, because we don't want them, I would think that that gives a higher probability of a soft or softish landing if they do pause and kind of see how the lags are taking effect, as opposed to continuing on at a very rapid rate increase.
Yeah, and I think these next few weeks, in addition to whatever other economic data we're getting, we are kicking off earnings season as well. So it'll be interesting to see what the language is out of some of these earnings reports, and the focus perhaps there will be on of course the prices that some of the relevant companies are paying, but then also what they're seeing in terms of the supply chain, and then more importantly for me, I'd like to see what they're going to start talking about in terms of, on top of the earnings, is their plans for hiring, firing, or laying off to potentially improve earnings, because we know as earnings fall, one of the easiest ways for people to improve them is to start cutting down the workforce. So my ears are going to be listening in for that, or my eyes are going to be looking for that as well, to see what the language is on that jobs front.
Yeah, and it certainly seems anecdotal evidence so far of hiring freezes or layoffs, but you haven't really seen it come through in the numbers yet. So certainly the anecdotes typically happen before the layoffs, but we'll keep an eye on both, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, let's get into the topic of the week then. As I discussed earlier, the University of Michigan had their 5 to 10 year inflation expectations number that Chair Powell has referenced in the past as something that I was going to say spooked him, but that was the ECI is what spooked him. The inflation expectations number is just something he pointed to as why they needed to continue their rate increases. But why don't we, Sam, why don't you dive into it a little bit in terms of what they do, how they run it, and we'll kind of tear it apart in terms of something that we really feel is, as we've talked about in the past, don't necessarily like survey data, but we'll talk about it once we get into the details a little bit more.
Yeah, so the inflation expectations component that we're going to focus on here, and it's really part of a larger, much broader survey that's conducted by the University of Michigan. It falls under what I believe they call their surveys of consumers that has been going on for, I saw on the website, they're saying that it's been going on since 1946. And as of the October print, which is the preliminary numbers, it hasn't been finalized. That is the 651st survey that's been conducted in the survey, or in that overall survey since the inception there. But with it, if you're you can find all the data readily accessible on the University of Michigan website within the subpart of the surveys of consumers. What you're going to see there is, despite the October being the preliminary data that came out today, the most recent comprehensive data set that you can dive into is going to be the August print, or the August release, I should say there, because the preliminary number, they're not going to have any information on. I wasn't quite sure why September wasn't available either, because it looked like they print or they released the data as a month end for each respective survey month. But then after a little bit digging, I saw that they put them they self-embargoed themselves for 30 days after the final release before they release it, before they publish it. So I suppose we'll be seeing the September data come out a little bit in the coming weeks. But basically, these periodic surveys, they're there to provide assessments of consumer attitudes and expectations. And then they use that to evaluate economic trends and prospects there. Within there are three primary components. There's the, the current sentiment. There's also expectations. And then I'm forgetting the third one right there, Jeff, but there's a third component within there as well. But ultimately, when they conduct these surveys as this part of a broad survey of consumers there, they target approximately 420 cases for their preliminary releases there, but the actual number, fluctuates based on the interview schedules. And then ultimately what they're trying to achieve is roughly 600 observations before they release that final number there. And the survey, they say they employs a simple random sample selection from a list of all possible cell phone numbers that are available in the 48 coterminous states, including the District of Columbia, to hope to achieve a sample set that's nationally representative. When you start to dig in through this data, you'll see that there's a number of tables that they provide with a lot of different subsections of various questions that they ask. If you're looking for the inflation expectations, those are on tables 32 and 33 for X, and the label or the title that they give for those charts are, or for those tables, are expected changes in price over the next year. That's table 32. And then over the next 5 years, which I'm assuming is the next 5 to 10 years, even though it's labeled as next 5 years, because within the table that's how it is represented as the next 5 to 10 years for inflation expectations. But the questions for these respective tables there is, during the next 12 months or over the next 5 to 10 years, do you think prices in general will go up or go down or stay where they are now? And the follow-up question to that is, by about what percent do you expect prices to go up? Notice I say just go up. They don't talk about going down, but the expectation of prices going up on the average during the next 12 months or over the next 5 to 10 years, depending on, again, which survey question and which respective table, either 32 or 33 that you're looking at. So effectively, based on that manner of questioning within that survey, it gives you the median increase in price over that specific term of 12 months or 5 to 10 years. So ultimately, based on a survey, there's no real option for median decreases. There's just basically what you see that comes out on these tables is either a median and or mean increase in expectations for inflation over whichever window of time that you have. And as we've talked about in the past, it's really hard to determine what your expectations are for inflation over the next 12 months or even, the next 5 to 10 years, especially. But looking at this, when I was looking at the table there, you get some pretty wide-ranging responses there. It seems like 25% of the respondents did indicate that their expectation for changes in prices over the next year, the next 12 months, was 10% or higher. And roughly half of those indicated 15% price increase over the next year. So that's a pretty big band. And I think a lot of that just comes back to the fact that most people, you know, perhaps, you know, one of the problems with, or the fallacies here is that, you know, we equate that to overall price basket inflation, but I guess right here, they're just asking for expected changes in prices and not really diving down into what constitutes that basket of prices that people are talking about. So perhaps they're looking at, you know, the recent increase in their gas prices, right, at the pump or, you know, at the grocery store, and they're just basing that as the reflection of price changes as a whole over the next, you know, 12 months, let's say. And that doesn't necessarily translate into what people would think or what would be measured through the CPI baskets that we just talked about from this last Thursday's print. But what was interesting also, just to kind of look and take a peek through, is they do break down these expectations and price changes by age, by income cohort, by education, and also political affiliation, different buckets within there. And what I saw, they broke down age into three buckets. They also broke down income into three buckets. And each one of those buckets, the expectation for the median increase in price changes on a one-year basis were pretty tight. I mean, they're pretty consistent across over the, looking at it when they actually show the data going back the last 12 months. You can see that within those cohorts or between those cohorts, the median increase was pretty tight within those three buckets for age and income. But when you get out to political affiliation, they break it out by Democrat and Republican, and the gap is pretty wide. I mean, if you're looking at the August data, the median increase in price in those who identify as within the Democrat party, their affiliation, the median increase for August was 3.8%. And then when you flip it over to the Republican bucket, that was at 6.9%. So a pretty big difference in terms of the median increase, at least within those political affiliations there. So I guess that's pretty expected. I guess you'd have various swings depending on which administration is in the office. And they do provide this across a number of the various sectors that they question and query respondents to. So it is pretty interesting if people have any interest in taking a look at the University of Michigan survey questions there. They can find it on the website and just kind of parse through it. And this, to me, is more kind of just curiosity than, again, I don't really take much use from it, especially, you know, based on some of the questions that I saw on the way that they break down the information.
Yeah, but I thought it was interesting. I thought it was interesting, though, also that the difference got pretty minimal in terms of your political affiliation when you go look out the next 5 years. That came pretty compressed. Period, right? Yeah. Well, it's interesting that as you talked about, you know, we always think of it the next 5 to 10 years, but really the table says the next 5 years. But then if you also can go through the questionnaire, they do say, what's your outlook for prices over the next 5 to 10 years? And they ask this right after the question of what's your outlook for prices over the next 12 months. So to me, you know, you could probably get, there's probably, if we had enough data, you could probably look and see if there's biasing towards, you know, if you think the next 12 months inflation is going to be high, you would expect the next 5 to 10 years to also be high. And so if you think that number is pretty high, you're probably biasing yourself to a higher number over the next 5 to 10 years. Now, certainly the next 12 months is going to be a component of the next 5 to 10 years, especially if you're looking at 5 years, that's, you know, 20% of your inflation over the next 5 years. But it's interesting that, I would be interested in, you know, if you had more data to see whether there was biasing one way or the other. But also, it's pretty interesting they go through the kind of the survey questions and how it works. Whereas if you say if you think outlook for prices over the next 5 years is going to stay the same, then they have kind of a follow up question. Do you mean that it won't go up or it's going to stay the same as it is right now? So, you know, if we had 8% inflation, you say it's going to stay the same. Do you think it's going to be 8% from here per year, or do you think that by stay the same you mean it's actually going to be zero? So at least they have that follow-up question. And then you know, they always talk about if your answer is greater than five, they want to clarify that your number actually is per year and not like 5% cumulative over the next 5 years. Certainly that's a good good thing to clarify, but it's interesting they say it's only greater than five, so that kind of again, biases those numbers. So if you say four and you meant 4% over the next 5 years, so sub 1% per year, they're not going to actually ask that follow-up question. They're just going to assume that's 4% over the next 5 years. But it's interesting to go through and you know, I think a lot of it is because they want to compare, you know, this, what did you say, 649th time series. They don't want to change things too much because they always want to make sure that the data that you're getting today is comparable to the data that you're getting from 1946. But it's just interesting to go through it. And as they go through, and now you talked about how it's based on cell phone data. You know, I think it was better when it was landlines, because your landline, you had your area code, you had your prefix, and it was kind of, that's your area that you live in. So you could get a, you know, representative sampling across the country. Whereas now, if you move across the country, you know, if you move from, you know, California to New York, just to pick two places that are far apart, you keep your cell phone number, right? You keep your same area code, your same prefix. And so at least from my perspective, you're not going to get the same sampling that you would get when it was back in using landlines.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just looking at the questions too here, you just got to figure it's the number of questions that they ask here, and there's somewhat of a decisioning tree too, as you know, if you answer A, then go do 12B. If you answer C, then go to 12C, you know, that type of thing. So you got to figure there's some decisioning fatigue and then answering fatigue by the time you get to the bottom, you know, set of questions here that you just want to get off the phone at that point. You just wonder how valid, you know, some of this information is by that point.
Yeah, and there are 28 questions. I just went to the bottom of the questionnaire, 28 questions, and you know, sometimes just A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and H parts. So certainly that's a lot of questions to be answering. And certainly if I received this phone call, I would not want to participate.
Yeah, I actually tried to look up the phone number that they might be calling from. So it's not that I answer my phone regularly, or even I barely answer my phone, but that's one of those, you know, do not disturb, go to do not disturb for sure if you see that area code. And I wasn't even able to get that. So a little public service there. If I would have found it, I would have announced it there. So,
but they do look at, you know, this is the August data. They did up 602 people. July was 601, June was 602. So they pretty much hit that 600 number, you know, give or take. It looks like it's at least 600. So they probably just go through and continue dialing until they get that 600th answer.
That's right. And it seems like they, there's not that many. I saw that there was a response in there that allowed people to say, I don't know, or yeah, don't know. And it did seem like to be a very small percentage within there as well, at least for the inflation expectations. I didn't go through the entire thing, but it does seem like people are actually answering. So, and like I said, it's table 32 and 33 out of, I think there's 46 components there. So it's a pretty decent hit rate.
Yeah. Well, so with that, let's get into the things to keep an eye on for next week. It's going to be a snoozer of a week, hopefully. Fingers crossed. Tuesday, we get some manufacturing data, including the industrial production data for September. That's expected to be up 0.1% from a negative 0.2% last month. Wednesday, we get the beige book, which is kind of symbolic for the week, being beige and boring and all. Thursday, we get the jobless numbers as usual. And then also on Thursday, we get the LEI for September. That's estimated to be a negative 0.3%. It was a negative 0.3% last month. We have a positive 0.2% rolling off. So that should keep the year number solidly in the negative realm. So no big move there. Still showing recession, very recessionary. And that's it for the things to keep an eye on for next week.
Yeah, we do have a whole host of Fed speakers coming out, starting with, it looks like, Bullard's coming out tomorrow, putting in work on a Saturday there. He's going to be talking about inflation. It doesn't say where, based on this quick summary that I have. But then also Bostic, Kashkari are out there. Charlie Evans. So that should be a good one to listen to as well. So quite a few names coming out next week to see if that might stir up the market a little bit. But it seems like they'll probably toe the line unless there's any surprises that we see there.
Yep. So we'll keep an ear out for those. With that, I guess that wraps it up again for this week, Sam, and I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in.
Yeah, thanks everyone for listening to us out there. This is Monday Morning Minutes, in case you forgot what you're listening to. You can catch us each Monday before the bell, and we should be available on your favorite podcast platforms by now. If we're not, or if you have any questions, you have any suggestions for the topics of the week, you can go ahead and email us at minutes@doubleline.com or hit us up on the Twitter, D-Line Minutes. Jason Ferrent taught me a new word today. This week. It's called tweeple. So if there's any tweeple out there that want to hit us there, it's D-Line Minutes.
And don't forget, you can find more information about Double Line at our website, doubleline.com. YouTube channel is youtube.com/doubleline capital, where we have both Ken Shinoda and Jeff Sherman doing separate TV appearances. I think they were almost simultaneous. I was at the airport, so I caught Jeff Sherman's, and I had to catch Ken's on the replay because I didn't make it through security in time to watch Ken. Also, there's a new episode of The Sherman Show out with Phil Huber. And if you're into wrestling, there was some good wrestling talk there. Make sure to follow Jeff and Sam on the Twitter for all you tweeple out there at Sherman Show Pod. Hope everyone has a great week.
Yeah, thanks everyone, and good luck out there.
The audio presentation represents DoubleLine's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media in any form without the express written permission of DoubleLine. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from DoubleLine, please contact media@doubleline.com. Neither DoubleLine nor any of its affiliates make any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Liability, including in respect of direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is expressly disclaimed. DoubleLine is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice in this podcast. The receipt of this podcast by any listener is not to be taken as constituting the giving of investment advice by any DoubleLine entity or individual to that listener, nor to constitute such person a client of any DoubleLine entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but does not imply low risk. Copyright 2022, DoubleLine.